I'm Ashley, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 10th of 2000. I got sober 10 days after my 18th birthday. I love that God gave me this topic because I hate it. I hate this topic so bad. When I got sober, I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there were all these old people there. And I didn't feel that I belonged there. And all of a sudden, all these people were looking at me and saying, oh, I wish I got sober at the age that you did. You didn't have to go through what I went through. And it made me think, maybe, just maybe, I could go back out there. Maybe I could go back out there to the point where I was in my 50s, like some of you came in, or even your 30s, you know. It's like, I wanted to go back out there. And I sat there, and I debated, and I'd listen to people's stories, and I can tell you that when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had nothing. I was living in my car, and I had the typical alcoholic car. It was this huge boat, and in order to start it, I had to climb up into the engine and stick a screwdriver in it and then hop back out and start it. And that's where I did all my drinking. And I remember one time I heard this lady talking, and she was like, I used to hide my bottles all out over in the house. And I thought, well, you know what? I did that, but mine were at telephone poles. I'd be driving, and I'd decide, well, if I get pulled over, I don't want to get caught with all this in my car, so I would stash it at telephone poles. So then people would be, like, driving down the road and see this crazy 18-year-old out there with these, or I guess I was younger than that, but, and I'd be searching for my freaking alcohol because I couldn't remember which pole I hit it at. And so here I am in the rooms, and I'm listening, and I'm trying to relate to all these old people. And at one point, somebody's talking about DUIs, and I'm like, I've had a few of those. My first one was 6 months after I got my driver's license. And I remember I ran a stop sign and almost hit my best friend, actually. And all of a sudden, I hear, pull the car over. I'd driven like a mile without realizing the cop was behind me. And I pull over, and I'm sitting there thinking, okay, I got to be able to hide all this booze, so I'm shoving it everywhere, right? And, of course, it's spilt all over in the car, so it smells like it as soon as the cop comes up. And at that time, they didn't handcuff minors, so he put me in the back seat of his cop car. And I'm back there, and I'm thinking, I can still get out of this, right? I've already blown in the machine that they do on the side of the road, but I'm thinking, I can still get out of this. So I'm in the back seat of that cop car, and he's got a pine air freshener. And I'm thinking, if I chew on that, it'll help, right? Now, don't ask me. So I'm chewing on this damn air freshener. I'm thinking, oh, God, I'm going to throw up. And then I realized that if you suck on a penny, that's supposed to screw up the machine, right? So I put this penny in my mouth, and all of a sudden, I had to swallow the damn penny. I don't know if it ever came all the way through or not, but, hey, I swallowed it. So here I am, I'm still in those meetings, and I'm still trying to relate to all of you. And somebody's talking about suicide attempts, and I did that. I did it several times. I used to burn myself, because if I burned myself, it shut my head off. It would shut it off long enough that I could manage to sit there. I was also the type of girl that, I mean, I was... At this time, I'm probably like 16 years old, and I'd go out to the garage, and I couldn't find anybody to get me alcohol, so I'd sit there and I'd huff shit, you know, and I would do anything I possibly could to shut my head off. And I heard that in meetings. So here I am. I'm trying to figure out if I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. One day, I had a sponsor, and it's funny because I waited 18 months to get a sponsor because my very first sponsor, she claimed that she had 12 years of sobriety. And I went to an assembly, and she was higher than a kite. A year later, she died in a DUI driving. So those sponsors, they lie. And I wasn't going to get one. I wasn't going to get another one. So at 18 months of sobriety, I was still doing the exact same behavior, but I was sober doing it. I was still stealing stuff. I was still lying. I was still beating the crap out of whoever I could beat the crap out of. And I was still doing all the behaviors, and I finally got a sponsor. And this lady was wonderful. Oh, she was wonderful. And I remember I called her one day, and I said, "Honey, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I really don't. I think I can go back out there, and I can drink until everybody else did, you know." And she goes, "Honey, do you think normal people debate whether they're an alcoholic or not?" And I thought about it. My mom is a total normie. She's a normie. She has never once thought, "I wonder if I'm an alcoholic." She's never done that. And for me, that was the first time that I had ever truly accepted something. And I accepted the fact that I belonged here and nobody could take my seat from me. So by God, you're not taking my seat, even if it's up here where I don't want to be. The next time that I had to truly accept something was when I accepted my higher power. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous where my mother was Mormon and my father was Catholic. And I tell you what, there was a lot of debate in my family of which God was right. And I didn't want either of them. I didn't want any of them. So I come in here and you guys are saying the Lord's Prayer. And I'm like, my mama says that ain't good. My dad says it is, but my mama says no. So I'm sitting in here and I'm feeling so conflicted. You know, what higher power do I have to have? And my sponsor finally sat down with me and she says, "Honey, it can be whatever you want it to be. It doesn't have to be what one person says. It doesn't have to be what the other person says. It can be whatever you need it to be." And that day I remember, we all know what that deep black hole is inside of us that we always try to fill. And I remember the day I woke up and it was gone. And I knew there was a God. I knew it wasn't you and it wasn't me. And that's all I needed to know. I'm one of those people back in the day, I used to have to really dissect every religion to try to figure out which one was right. And today, I don't have to do that. Today, I just have my little list of what my God needs to be, and that's my God. The last time I was in Atlanta was a horrible experience for me. It was Icky Paw. And I came here pregnant, and I left not pregnant. And I tell you what, I have a blood clot disorder. And I was here with my sponsor, who is an RN, and she took care of me the whole time. But me accepting the fact that I have this blood clot disorder was a big deal for me. You know, today I know God gave me two miracle babies that I should never have had. But accepting the fact that I have that, you know, and it's okay. You know, I'll be fine. I have so many blessings that I can't even name. So I have to tell you, I had this boyfriend. You know, in the big book, it talks about when you had arrived, right? So when I was in high school, there was this homecoming king, and he was amazing. And he was all like the guy that everybody looked at, right? And I managed to manipulate him into marrying me. And I married him, and he's the one that I have two beautiful children with. In 2009, he got in an accident at work, and it caused some brain damage. And it affected the part of the brain which is your personality and your memory. And I thought I handled that pretty well. You know, I thought, I can accept the way that he is. I can accept the way that my life is now. My children will never know the man that I married. So here I am. I'm married to him. He's got this brain injury, and I'm thinking I can walk through this. I can walk through this. And I tell you what. I've been in locked in bedrooms. I've been locked in other places where he won't let me out. And just recently, I've had to accept that my marriage is over. And as much as I wanted to stay, you know, I want to stay. I want to fix him. I want the freedom through acceptance. And it's just not going to happen. And so I'm having to walk away from that marriage after being with him for 17 years. And so when I got the email to talk on freedom through acceptance. The funny thing is that I'm sitting at my office, and I'm looking up divorce attorneys, and I get this goddamn email that says, we want you to speak on freedom through acceptance. And I'm like, okay, so am I supposed to accept him for how he is or accept that my marriage is over? I'm really mind-screwing this. And I tell you, I love how God works because I've been here and I've been on to several different panels that have just been amazing. And it's everything that I've needed. And I know as soon as I leave here, I'm going to have freedom through accepting how this talk went and I don't have to do it again. I don't know. There's been several different times in my sobriety where I've had to have the freedom through acceptance. And I'm just truly grateful that I've had the sponsorship that I've had to walk me through it. My mind went blank, and I still have like 9 minutes left. You know what? I'm just truly grateful to be here, and I'm going to stop early, so thanks for the show.
Okay, thank you so much, Ashley. Well, that was amazing. Next, we're going to have Jamie M. from Florida.
Hi. Whew. Hi, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 13, 1994, and my name is Jamie. Jamie. And my home group is the Tamarack Group. And I was real nervous right before I got here, and then I saw my homies. I feel like I'm at an assembly. I feel like I'm in Nova at my district meeting. I feel like I'm home, and I'm not nervous. I'm nervous, of course, because you have to speak, and I got the email that she got, and so I opened it and said, we'd like you to speak at the international convention. So I closed my email. I called my sponsor. I said, I think I got a prank email, and she said... She didn't say, you idiot, but I heard this. You idiot? How do you think they get in contact with you? And I want to thank the committee for asking me and my past delegate for putting my CD in. And this is what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a Sunday in 1994, and I knew I drank too much. I just didn't want to drink so much. You know, and my brother-in-law came in like a year before me. He was in NA, and he said there was a place for me. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous my whole life. My 80-year-old father knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't. Because when I made my amends to him, he goes, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Dad, you know about that? Okay, so, born and raised in New York City. And I say that in Brooklyn because you learn everything in the streets. You know, I came from a good home, you know, nice parents. My mother was a gambler, and I just, when I got sober, I found out my grandmother was a bootlegger. So if you're young, you don't know what a bootlegger is during the roaring 20s, when they didn't have alcohol, my grandmother drove those cars and got you the booze for the whoopee parties that are in the big book. That's my family. And, you know, it was a great way to grow up, but very screwed up. I had no idea about that. You know, I met my first boyfriend. I was 14, and he was a pure junk addict, druggie. And it scared me to death. I didn't want it, but he was older than me. He was able to get me the Boone's Farm and the Matus, and I was fine with that, you know. And like everything else in my life, anytime I did anything, I got in trouble the first time. Okay, so the first time we fooled around, I got a baby. But in 1970, nobody asked you how you felt. Nobody said, how do you feel, Jamie? Do you want to keep this baby? They made decisions for me, and they gave my baby up. And I started getting colder. In my family, everybody in the family called me Ice. And I was cold. I mean, if you... did anything to me, I could cut you off by the throat. I wouldn't look at you again for the rest of my life. If you told my husband how much I drank, you were not my friend anymore. That year I gave up the baby. My mother died. My father, my sister, and my brother got remarried. All three got married. I was nowhere. Where was I going to be? So I landed up going to California to an uncle. And I stayed there for a year, and they brought me back home because I swore I would never do anything bad, you know. And I took that geographical move, and it didn't do anything. But at the same time, coming home, my father was able to accept that boyfriend. And as soon as he accepted him, I walked out the door. I never looked back at that guy either. So if you have kids that want the guy that's really bad, don't forbid them to do that. Anyway, I met my husband, who's my husband today, and next month we'll be celebrating 39 years. I know. And I contribute that to AA for saving my life, but Al-Anon for saving our marriage. He went into Al-Anon 4 months after me. And thank God he did. I hated Al-Anon for it in the beginning, you know. He would put that Al-Anon O on me or lock himself in the bedroom when I was a ranting, raving lunatic. And I'd say, come out here. I need to fight. And he goes, I wasn't invited to this fight, and I don't have to attend. I guess you guys have some Al-Anons in your life. But that saved our marriage. We learned to live in the same household and not kill each other. Because I literally once went after him with a knife. You know, I was not very pleasant. If you didn't do what I wanted in the house, including my kids, I threw everything on the floor. I had tantrums like a child. They say when you pick up that drink, you stay that age. I was. I was a tantrum thrower. I pushed my daughter up against the wall one time, who's now 34, and she was much bigger than me. And I pushed her up against the wall, and my husband said, look where you are. And I said, yeah. And he said, Jamie, do you want to go to that next place? I had to think about it. I didn't hit her. I just put my hands down, and I said, okay. Anyway, I came in. You know, the last drink I had was not my worst. Wasn't my worst at all. It was, I was sick and tired of it. And I was going out with some friends, and I got drunk. And this is the week before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went from Benihana's, and my husband was my stopwatch. He would say, after two drinks, out, you had enough. So I would have two drinks while I was putting my makeup on, two drinks with him, and I'd dump your ass. Oh, excuse me, I'm on tape. And then I'd go home and drink the way I wanted. And he knew it. So he would control it, and I was okay with it. You know, I grew up in a household where my dad made all the decisions, and I went from daddy's house to my husband's house. And I was okay with that. I never wrote a check till I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I became the treasurer of my first home group, my husband said, I am not the treasurer of the Coral Springs group. And so the guys in the Coral Springs group came over and taught me how to write a check. You know, I think everything that I didn't know, the people in AA taught me. My husband, when he gave me my medallion, he said, AA gave you so much. They taught you how to get on a highway to go to a quarterly. They taught you how to get onto a computer. And they keep you sober together. And, you know, a lot has happened in the years I'm sober. And I had to accept a lot of things in my life. I don't have to like it, but I have to accept it. You know, I have that child is back in my life. And about 2 months ago, she had an alcoholic seizure, the one I gave up for adoption. And I was in the hospital with her, and her kids were, you know, I'm in touch with her. We got in touch in 1999. She got in touch with me because her mother wanted to know what my genes were like. Oh, boy. Her father was a drug addict, and I was an alcoholic. And I'm in recovery, but anyway, so I'm the only big book she ever sees. And I told her that, you know, if you need a meeting, there's one across the street from your house. I'll be more than happy to take you. She's texted me during these last 2 months. Do you think if I have one drink, I'll have a seizure? I don't know that, honey. I don't say yeah. I don't say no, because they teach you in here. I can't tell you if you're an alcoholic. Do I know she is? Yeah. Do I know she does drugs? Yeah. But there's nothing I can do. I have to be there and wait for her. So I don't always like waiting, but I do it. When I first had my first sponsor, I picked her because she was nice and quiet, and I wasn't. I was uncomfortable in my own skin. And I just got a compliment a couple of years ago, and my sponsee said to me, "You know, you have peace within." I went, "Yeah?" I was like, "Oh, boy." I was excited. And my sponsor, who's my sponsor today for many, many years, I went to hear her speak this morning. And you know what? She's standing up there, and I'm looking. I'm going, I still want what she has so much. She keeps me so busy. We meet on Tuesday when all my friends are in town. We call each other the Big Book Buddies. She did the steps with me. And then we do the traditions together. And we did the service manual. And now we're on the concepts for, oh, God, 2.5 years, I think. But you know what? It keeps us growing together. I'm the baby of the group. I'm with all these, well, there's one other girl that's in 27 years, but all the rest are in 30s. And they're all recovering alcoholics that do service. You know, when I first got this sponsor, she had about 12 years of sobriety, and she was cleaning the coffee pot with me. I'm thinking, how come you're cleaning the coffee pot? She goes, I never get over alcoholism. I always have to give back. So about 6 years into sobriety, I got into service. My home group decided it was time. I did everything in the home group. They said, you need to be the alternate GSR. I have kids. I have a house. I have a job. What are you talking about? They said, don't worry. You'll be all right. So for 2 years, it was okay because I didn't have to always go to the meetings. But I fell in love with general service. I've done other service. I brought meetings into BARC, BCIC, for over 3-4 years. I loved it. I did intergroup when I first got sober and started getting into service. But general service is my home. And I love general service because you grow with it. I didn't know I lived the traditions until I started general service. You know, you start breaking a tradition. Boy, somebody will tell you right away. And I heard once somebody say, you know, nobody would break a tradition if they knew they were breaking it. And to me, that's very important. Uh-oh. How am I doing? Oh, good. Good. Okay. So those things are real important to me. You know, I was real nervous today, and one of my friends hugged me so tight, I felt her heartbeat. And I knew that God was there. And that's important. And when she came over this week, she came over for a haircut, and she says, are you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm going to 6 minutes here, 6 minutes there. She goes, you're planning what you're saying? Okay, I won't plan. I won't think. And I didn't. I let it go. I let it go, and I'm glad I did. I have to tell you that 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with liver cancer. And I had hepatitis C 2 years into recovery, and I was pissed off. I said, how could this be? I'm sober. I'm not even a drug addict. One time I did. One time. And so I heard that they were getting a cure for hep C, so I went to the doctor. When I got there, he tells me, you have liver cancer and you need to go to UM immediately. I went, hold on. You're scaring me. So I went to UM the next day. And he got me an appointment. I couldn't get one for a month. And when I left the doctor's office, I called my sponsor in the car. And my husband goes, who are you calling? I said, I have to call my sponsor. I got to hear her voice. And she said these amazing words to me. And it centered me. She said, God has a plan. And you don't have to know what it is. And when I got off the phone, I was within God. I knew that those words came from God, from her to me. And that night, we had our big book meeting, and I went there, and I flopped down on my sponsor's couch, and I cried a little bit, and we talked, and all of us talked, and they had a plan. You know, they had a plan. They weren't letting me sit on my couch and isolate. They kept me busy. Boy, they had a convention, and I couldn't get involved with it, so they made up a committee for me. And I... Swear to God, I had a committee that was made up. And, you know, when I told them that, they go, no, it was real, a committee. I said, yeah, okay. But you know what? By the time the convention happened, I had surgery already. So I was recuperating. I couldn't do a lot of physical work, but I was able 2 years before to help on the speaker committee, and I helped pick the speakers. And what an honor that was. 40 tapes we listened to of all great speakers. but I got the opportunity to do that. So after the first surgery, we found out that they couldn't cut it out. I needed a new liver. And because I had a pre-existing, I needed $200,000. I don't know about you. I don't have $200,000. So when I told the guy in UM, he said to me, oh, a lot of people have $200,000. That's what he said, arrogant. My husband didn't take the phone away because I was going to say things that weren't very nice. And the fellowship came through. And my sponsor, who has many, many years, says she never saw the fellowship come together like this. They had a fundraiser for me. They didn't raise $200,000. They raised a lot, enough that I could live on for the year that I had to take off of work. Okay? And what that did for me was gave me the strength to fight like I never fought before. I fought when I came in here because I wanted what you had. I had the willingness. I did anything you told me to do. If it was cleaning garbage cans, I loved to be on the cleanup committee. We like being on the cleanup committee, you know. I was willing to do anything. And so it gave me strength. And somebody told us that there was a meeting of insurance representatives in Tamarack, which is like 6 minutes from my house. And I went there, and 25 of our friends were there with T-shirts for me, a liver for Jamie. And I talked on a mic like this. And before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a secretary of an electrical group. And for me to stand here, I used to have two drinks, and then I would take my foot while I was behind this podium and stab myself with the heel of my foot so I could feel the pain so I wouldn't be scared. So I stood there, and I told her what happened with my insurance and everything. And I made them cry on the panel. And afterwards, one of them said, go talk to our interns, and we're going to get you a liver with or without insurance. And I left there, and they happened to ask my friends, tell me about Jamie. And they told her about AA without saying AA. You know, I'm here to do service. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm one of the crazy people that, you know, I can't get enough of it. I can't do enough for what they gave me back my life. So she got me that liver. I had the appointment the next day in Broward General, and the doctor was really annoyed with me because he said, I don't know who you know. I said, I don't want any favors. I just want my fair share. If I meet the criteria, fine. If I don't, okay, then I'm not supposed to. I met the criteria. And what happened is 3 months, 5 days later, I got a liver. That was a miracle. And I had to accept before that I might not get it. I might not turn 60. I might not see my daughter 30. I might never come to another international convention. And that's what I was saying. I might never do these things, but I walked with courage. I walked with faith that God was taking care of me. God had a plan. And I said it, and I said it. It was a mantra for me. And, you know, God does have a plan for us. You know, I have sponsees here. I have a new sponsee, nine months. I mean, who has this? I have my sponsor here, all my friends from my home group, the district, people we exercise with, crazy people, animals. But... No, I mean it nicely. But we do this together. And we do this for four reasons. And the four reasons, like Dr. Bob says, is one, is a sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. And four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. And for me, that's everything. That's everything. You know, I'm still, my sponsor still has these things that we're doing. You know, they plan things for me all the time that have taken years now. And they're like, okay, in 2000-something, you're going to do this. Okay. I don't say no because I know God has a plan, and I don't know where it's going to take me. It took me to the international convention. This is my third international. And the first one, I was scared out of my wits. I hated it. No telephones in Toronto, and scary. You leave little notepads. Meet me in the hospitality room. And the second one, I was with my friends from my home group, and we had a whole hotel, it seemed like. We were 25 of us. We just left the airport on Wednesday. We were 30 people in a picture. I mean, we're crazy. I feel bad for the people on the plane, you know. We're not a glum lot. And today, I'm free. I have freedom from the acceptance of whatever comes down the pike. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Jamie. And next up, we have Laura C. from New York.
I'm Laura. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me in the back? No. That means yes, right? If you say, I'll get closer. So I'm Laura, I'm an alcoholic, and on Monday I celebrated 20 years of sobriety. Which was something I'd been projecting about for 20 years. Took me 20 years to get it, so it meant a lot to me. And I remember coming in at 21 and being told that maybe I should do some more experimenting. And, you know, I didn't get here at 21 because things were going well. You know, I'd sort of lost everything I had to lose. And I also, when I saw the topic, it's a little ironic. I was one of those people. Was it in the third edition, was it page 449 or 469? 449, right? And then it moved. And I was one of those people that was so happy it moved, because this acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. Like, I definitely was looking for an answer to all my problems. And I didn't find that acceptance was always it. So, but I think today, so the topic is freedom through acceptance. I really enjoyed that one of our valiant volunteers was announcing this meeting as freedom from acceptance, which is not what this meeting is. It's freedom through acceptance. And as I thought about that, you know, what the way I'd like to talk about acceptance is that it's for me, acceptance can be a key. It can be a basis. It can be a starting point. And the things that it is the key to for me is the decision on whether I need to change something or let go of something. And that's how I find the freedom, through acceptance. So I grew up, I'm a member of the Greenwich Village group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't believe any other members of the Greenwich Village group managed to make it here in time to get a seat. Is there anyone else here from the Greenwich Village? No, my sponsor didn't get in. Like, we did not get in. So it doesn't look like my home group here, let me tell you. which will let you know why I hesitated, because growing up a trans man in Arkansas in the 70s and 80s gave me a lot of interesting stuff to accept. My family, like almost every family I knew, was very fundamentalist Christian. And I was a quick study. So I was Bible Quiz Bowl champion, and I won the Christian Leadership Trophy, which was a big one, when I was 8. And then And everyone knew that I was a little tranny the whole time. Like, they were raising me as a boy named Laura for forever. And, you know, but this gradually I started understanding that some of the things the preacher said applied to me, which was easy to do since I was there 3 times a week. And so it became obvious to me that that God had something in store for me, like eternal damnation and burning and hellfires. And that was difficult for this little Bible scholar to take. And you know, one of the, but, you know, when you got beer and guns, who needs acceptance? And My father developed special purpose ammunition for Remington Arms, and I think that helped me make it through my childhood. But it, you know, he was, I assume he probably still is, a really tough guy, and I'm from a family of drunks, and one of the things that I've had to accept, this one took me 17 years of sobriety, I had to accept that I had to let go of my family, that my family was just too violent, too wasted, that it was just, I love my family. I love Arkansas. Arkansas is so beautiful. The food is good and fatty. It smells wonderful there. And there are no jobs for me, and there's no home for me, and there's no place for me. There's not a wife for me. I mean, I'm not safe there. So I had to get. My family, really not a safe place for me. I mean, I had, and it was a hard thing for me to accept, because we could dress it up for Christmas, you know, like for my birthday out came a cake, and these people seemed to love me, and that sort of was the basis of love, and boy, I loved them. I came from the kind of family where there was blood on the walls, but you get a piggyback ride to bed, you know, and so it was just, So to cut my family off, which I did about 3 years ago, like cut them off, like to say goodbye to mama, I mean, that is, woo, that, it's not been my favorite part of life. But one that has given me freedom, you know, freedom to be myself, and freedom to be happy, joyous, and free. Like the 2 week hangover before and after a visit home, It was too big a price for me to pay, but I want to talk about being sober. One of the things I think that it's easy for, it was easy for me to twist the steps. So I did lots of bad stuff when I drank, and then people, when they talked about step nine, would talk about living amends, and I thought living amends meant to kowtow to my family for the rest of my life, and that was, I lost a lot through that. I mean, it's been, I have needed sponsorship, and sometimes I've just needed common sense, and I've needed to learn to listen to listen to my own feelings, like that happy, joyous, and free. So, for example, tonight, I'm not going to the flag ceremony. I'm going to a baseball game. I want to watch people hit balls out of the park. I want to have a hot dog. I want to sing about Cracker Jacks. And I'm going to miss the flag ceremony. And all my good AA teaching says, it's the wrong thing to do. But no, like, I want to be my happy, joyous, and free, which may look different than yours. And I got sober to be able to have that. I got sober in Boston, and at first I lied about going to AA meetings, Boston Crossroads, and I came in young, and everyone looked older and not Southern, and, you know, they just, my sponsor had, like, a baseball cap and a fanny pack, and I was in a band, like, I was going to music school, and, you know, I thought I was pretty cool, but she said she had 14 years of sobriety. I thought she was lying. She actually wasn't. And she was so kind to me. And I learned the importance of a home group. You know, a home group has kept me sober. And Greenwich Village Group is home to me. And I accept that they can't make it in this room on time today. And they're still, you know, I love them on this tape. Also, my sponsor, like, my sponsor has the things that my sponsor has, just a few things that I want, but one of them is the most important thing to me. I mean, she's got longer sobriety than I have. The number one, here's what I should have said. You shouldn't say should, but here's what it would have made sense for me to lead off with. The one thing that all of us who were sober, including myself, accept kind of permanently is that a drink will be the end of me, that I cannot drink in safety. And the most important thing for me to accept is that for me to drink is to die. And whatever I have to do to not take a drink, it's not negotiable. So being able to accept that for me to drink is to die is the key to the freedom that is sobriety for me. So my home group, I accept the good and bad of them. My sponsor has what I want, meaning more sobriety than I have. She's also managed to stay alive a lot longer than me. I mean, and I get something out of talking to her. For me, the things that keep me sober: home group, sponsor, step work, and service. I have sponsees now, which I'm grateful for because they keep the steps alive for me. I've got one on step 4 and one on step 10. Which helps me remember, my own step path. Working the steps as an atheist with 20 continuous years in Alcoholics Anonymous has been a challenge from time to time, and I've had to kind of find my own way. It was a member of my home group, Barry L., who wrote Living Sober, and one of the things in those really neat chapters he has is find your own way. And I've had to figure out how the steps can make sense for me, and that has changed. So when I first worked the seventh step, I wrote a letter to GSO and asked them to remove my shortcomings. And and a really nice paper, like it was Japanese paper, and really, and my higher power wrote me back, and I got to carry this letter around in my pocket that said, stay on the path, keep working the steps, and it's gonna get better. And the woman who wrote that letter has 42 years and is a member of my home group today. And would be here if she could make it here to this meeting on time. But today when I worked the third step with my sponsees today, the first time we worked the third step together, this atheist gets on our knees and we hold hands and we say the third step prayer. And I've found that the Christianity, which forms the structure, the really healthy structure, and it sure does work, structure of AA, it's not been contagious. When I say the prayer, and we say the prayer every time before we work on step 4 together, just as a reminder that we've made a decision, that it's not, that the decision's been made, we are on this journey. And I found it very helpful. But it took me 10 years to kind of get to that point where I understood that the words were not going to send me to hell. And so the steps have changed as I've changed and been better able to accept them. Service gives me a chance to use my acceptance fairly frequently. That can range from, I make coffee for my home group on Friday nights, the step meeting, which is the small one for some reason. And I'm also the registrar for Southeast New York. So in Southeast New York, which has 13 counties, I handle the database and the mailings. And we've been kind of going through this thing, which may bore you to death, but you're already in the room, the door's shut. So so that people are converting. There's this thing called email. And most of the newer folks on our list, let's say all of them, want email. We have 1,700 people on the list. We have about 100 people at our assemblies. And the only way to get off the list is to die and have someone send us a letter and say, no longer with us, or for you to tell us to take you off the list. So I've got this long list that I've been sending out mail to folks who haven't been in service for a very long time. So I brought it to the group like, wow, this is, maybe we should convert to digital and save 10 grand a year. And we could, I can think of some 12-step work we might want to do with that money. And they basically told me that wasn't going to work out. So I've had to accept that. Like one of the things... One of the things that I accept in service is that the position is not mine, that it belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that generally there are clear directions for everything AA asked me to do. There were clear directions in that scary email that I had 20 minutes to speak on this topic. There are clear directions for what a registrar does, and it says mailings. And there are clear directions to just stay in sober, which are in the steps. I mean, my first sponsor told me that the 12 steps are suggested, like if you jump out of a plane, it's suggested you pull the parachute cord. Like it is just suggested, but it might lead to better results for us. You know, I'm happy to be here. I find the magnitude of our international conventions to be extremely overwhelming. Like when we're, I think that it's weird because a lot of us do have PTSD here. So to have everybody screaming up and down the elevator, like rah, 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 and there, you know, thousands and thousands of people in here, like it can be a terrifying experience. And this morning I basically sat in the dorm room like this so I'm trying to find the happy, joyous, free part of it, you know, and I think that what it makes me think of is that, I also have to accept the good things, like growing up the way I grew up and being myself. If times were good, if something felt good, I knew to like check my back. And some of the freedom from acceptance is to take some time to accept when things are good. You know, I've got an amazing relationship with my wife today. I am so lucky. I need to not be checking for signs of infidelity all the time. Like I need to accept when I'm given gifts as well as when things are hard for me. And that can be tough. I mean, I didn't get a lot of examples of, you know, well-adjusted relationships when I got here. One of the things I've had to accept many things about our fellowship. First, that we do have a tendency towards fundamentalism, which I recognize, which, you know, my home group doesn't necessarily have, but I hear it a lot. And I think sometimes, we can be exclusive, to people who might have some other issues. I think it can be tough for us to tolerate and welcome each other. I see that sometimes in enforcement of singleness of purpose. I think some folks, when they're really new, don't know they're alcoholics. Like I did, you know, I really knew I had a problem with drinking and that I was drinking every day and it was going to kill me. And I was so blessed to have that because no one could say to me, you know, maybe you don't belong here. It's my feeling that we need to be open to people who haven't figured out how they identify yet. I think that's sort of what open meetings are for. I've had to accept that it took us a lot of years to even get stories from someone like me in the spirituality pamphlet. That atheism is still so controversial here. And sometimes we have to, and the big book says that the reason for the big book is to lead you to God. I mean, it says that in no uncertain terms. It has not led me to God. It was written by some folks who, you know, whether or not they were divinely inspired, obviously I don't think they have been, you know, had a lot less time than me. And you know, I've managed to stay sober without that. And can we, in the 12 and 12, it talks about the hoop is really wide that we have to jump through. Like, I'd like us to keep it wide. You know, I'd like it to stay big. I've done a lot of sort of homework on AA, and our percentage of women has been about the same since the 70s. Like, basically since I was born, we've been about a third women and two-thirds men. Like, where are the women? And I think that in Southeast New York anyway, we're thinking about how do we make the meeting safe. Like if meetings feel like the creepy bar I just walked out of, you know, it might be hard. So how do we welcome women in our group? In Greenwich Village Group, it probably won't surprise you to know that it's vast majority gay men. And sometimes it's been a revelation to me that guys don't have to be straight to make women feel unwelcome. And and so we have to think about, like, how can we balance that out? Like, how can we, do we need to alternate men speakers, women speakers? Like, we've got a beginner's panel. We try to keep it gender diverse. But ways that we can accept each other and welcome each other in. You know, my whole family are alcoholics, and I'm the sober one. Like, I love them. I don't want them to die. Like, and I don't want them to keep inflicting the pain and suffering on the world. So it's really personal to me. And, you know, I try to, so do I accept AA exactly as it is and just love it because it saved my life? Or do I get to be kind of the fly in the ointment? I mean, I think that my role 20 years in, acceptance doesn't mean blind acceptance, or it might mean facing the reality. And I think that in AA sometimes we're just so happy that we got here. We made it to the island. Like, it's, we're you know, if we can keep doing what we're doing today, we probably won't die of this dread disease of alcoholism. Like, does that mean that I just pack it in and read the big book? And I would like as many people to get sober as possible in this fellowship that saved my life. And I'm not willing to just accept everything about us, including, look, I think that the first 164 pages of the big book are turning women away. I'm confident they are. Knowing that Bill W. wrote Two Wives because his wife wouldn't let, or his mistress wouldn't let his wife write it, like, that's a fun fact. Like, I think that acceptance doesn't mean fear of change. And until I can accept how, you know, it's, I don't truck by a lot of belief that a book can't be changed. I mean, that's, I think if women are dying of alcoholism because they feel condescended to by the big book, maybe we should wiggle it around a little bit. So, you know, if there's not enough room inside AA for everyone, I'm not comfortable. Anyway, thanks for asking me to speak. It was Linda M. who put my name in the hat. I'm glad that you're all here. If you have any issues with this, please speak to her. yeah. You know, my opinions aren't necessarily AA's opinions, but I share my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad I'm here. Thank you.